in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Prairie Ensemble, which presents Stravinsky's Complete Pulcinella Ballet, featuring dancers from the University of Illinois, on Friday, May 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. Also included are works by Granville Bantock, Francis Poulenc, and Joan Tower. Tickets and information available at 355-9077 or on the web at prairieensemble.org.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL, Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. George Bent was born in 1843 to a white trader and a Cheyenne woman. He was the product of two great families, powerful, prosperous, and influential families, but families of two very different worlds. Until his death in 1918, George Bent lived in both those worlds. Today on the program, we talk with the authors of a biography of this very interesting man. David Fridtjof Hollis and Andrew Masick are our guests. They are the authors of Half-Breed, the remarkable true story of George Bent, caught between the worlds of the Indian and the white man. George Bent was educated in white schools. He served for a time in the Confederate Army, but deserted and returned to the camps of the Cheyenne. He survived the Sand Creek Massacre of 1864, where more than 150 Indians, many of them women and children, were killed and their bodies mutilated. Later, he worked to preserve the memory of the Cheyenne by assisting prominent historians and ethnologists of the day. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. David Hollis is a former historian at the Library of Congress and the Colorado Historical Society. He is now Museum Division Director at Pittsburgh's Heinz History Center. Andrew Masick is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Historical Society of Western Pennsylvania. Our guests this afternoon are also the co-authors of Cheyenne Dog Soldiers. Their new book, Half-Breed, The Remarkable True Story of George Bent, is published by DeCapo Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. David, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Our pleasure.
George Bent was, as you note in the book, the son of the two most influential families on the High Plains during the formative years of the American West. First question is, how was it that William Bent, George's father, was able to begin and sustain a partnership with the Cheyenne?
Why don't I start? This is Andy Masick.
Okay.
William Bent, George's father, was a remarkable man in his own right. As a very young man, he headed west with a band of fur trappers, hoping to strike it rich in the mountains of the west, and he soon discovered that that was no way to make a living, with your feet in the icy streams of the Rocky Mountains, trying to catch beaver and then trade those pelts for gold back in St. Louis. And so he and his brother, Charles Bent, who later became the first governor of New Mexico under the United States, found that trading was the way to make a fortune. And so these two brothers built an adobe trading post, really a castle in the wilderness of southern Colorado on the Arkansas River. In the 1830s and 40s, the Indians came to them, the people of the plains, the Cheyennes and the Arapahos and the Comanches and the Kiowas all came to Bent's trading post. And it's there that he married Owl Woman, the daughter of the Cheyenne sacred arrow keeper, the most powerful man among the Cheyennes, and they began their family.
Hmm. What were relations between trappers and traders like William Bent and Charles Bent and American Indians in the first half of the 19th century?
Well, you know, in the early years, there was a pretty good alliance. In fact, white trappers often tried to marry into the tribes and that way cement, you know, a trade relationship, and that's what William Bent did. But William was different than most. He didn't choose just any Cheyenne woman. He chose the three daughters of the arrow keeper, who, as Andy just said, was the most important man among the Cheyennes. Mm. So his relationship with the tribe went to the very heart of it.
Yeah. Well, William Bent's relationship with Owl Woman's father, White Thunder, the keeper of the arrows, seems to me to be, just from what I can gather, a very special relationship.
I think it was. I think that it was certainly a marriage of convenience and power. It was the merging of two cultures and two peoples, the Cheyenne and the white people. But at the same time, I think they had a very special relationship. I think there was real love in the relationship. And they had a number of children who survived. George Bent was among them. George had an older brother, Robert, and had sisters as well. Later on, a younger brother came by one of William Bent's other wives. As David said, there were three sisters who ended up coming into William Bent's lodge. And that was fairly common among Cheyennes who could provide for multiple wives. I don't mean to say that plural marriage was necessarily common among the Cheyennes, but if the husband was a good provider, it was common for a sister, a woman, to bring her sister into the lodge as well, because she knew that her husband could provide for the sister. And if the man was an exceptional provider, then a second sister might, a third sister might come in. So I think that William had a very special relationship with Owl Woman, but then also with Island as well, and Yellow Woman, who was the third sister.
Right, and he saw it also as his responsibility to take care of Owl Woman's sisters.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. There's another element to it as well. Traditionally, great leaders had more than one wife because they needed help, you know, in hosting visitors and, you know, having dinners and that sort of thing. So they needed help, but they needed more than one woman to help with all that.
Hmm. And these women were not just servants. You know, the Cheyenne people hold women in high regard. And when usually what happens when a man marries a woman, the family goes to the woman's lodge, and the woman stays close to her mother's family. And so they're matrilocal. They go to the woman's family. And these women were strong characters, each of them, and had high standing in the tribe and were very much respected. And William Bent sometimes was a little frustrated in dealing with some of those women who preferred to live in a teepee or a lodge rather than the smelly, cramped quarters of the adobe fort that was Bent's domain. And so they had a very interesting relationship as they merged families and cultures.
Yeah, so the couple didn't live at the fort together.
They generally lived in a lodge or a teepee outside the walls of the fort. It's not that the children didn't play in the fort and, you know, consider it their territory, but the Cheyenne people knew that the teepee was a much cleaner, healthier environment. It could be moved easily. That was the whole idea of the the mobile home that was the teepee, is that it could be dragged on the back of a horse, the poles dragged behind, and the lodge skin made of buffalo hide or later canvas could be rolled up and packed and moved to a cleaner camp location where the water was better, where the grass was richer for the horses. And so the women knew that the lodge was probably the better environment for the children, who came very quickly.
I want to go back to the bond between William Bent and White Thunder, and how their relationship grew from one of practical matters into a personal bond. And it seems that this personal bond was forged or was strengthened one night during a meteor shower.
Oh yeah, the night the stars fell. That was a very famous event, 1833, and they happened to be at the fort together, and people thought that the world was ending, you know, and warriors donned their finest clothing and as if they were going to war, and mounted their ponies and went out to fight this battle against the stars, and then finally people just started to watch it, and that's when I think this bond between them was formed.
I remember them, George's report describing this scene as it was told to him. The White Thunder and William Bent stood side by side on the parapets of Bent's fort, this big adobe castle, watching the meteor shower, and he could see the faces of the women as they lined up in rows and sang around a bonfire set in the very center of the fort. And so people, the Indian people, the Cheyennes, gathered to the fort for protection during the night the stars fell.
And that night had followed a disaster for White Thunder and his people. The sacred arrows had been lost in a battle, so that meteor shower must have seemed really...
Oh,
yeah. Those were very tough times for White Thunder, and his responsibility was to care for the arrows. That was his sole responsibility. And here in the battle against the Pawnees, they were lost. And people felt that this might be the end of the Cheyenne people. How could they exist without, you know, the center of their life? So White Thunder was going through some hard times and was conceiving strategies to get the arrows back or to renew and create new ones. And it was at this very important time that the two men met, and this bond would last a lifetime and would bring the Cheyennes, in their connection with Bent, great wealth.
We should mention, too, that hundreds of years ago, a prophet by the name of Sweet Medicine went into the earth, into the center of the earth, and emerged days later, or a long time later, with four arrows, two man arrows and two buffalo arrows. And these arrows became symbols of the Cheyenne, and the man arrows ensured protection of the tribe from all of their human enemies, and the buffalo arrows would ensure the tribe food in the form of buffalo, which of course were very plentiful on the plains of the American West at that time, and provided not only food for the Cheyenne people, but their lodge skins. The sinews were used, the bones were used, every part of the buffalo was utilized by the Cheyenne people. So those arrows, those sacred arrows, meant life for the Cheyenne people.
What were relationships like between the American Indian peoples of the Southern Plains?
Between the Indian people?
Yes, between the peoples, between the tribes.
Yeah, well, sometimes it was cooperation, sometimes it you know, was not. When the Indians found the horse and went out onto the plains, their lives were transformed. We all know that, but I don't think we really understand the extent to which it changed them. They became instantly wealthy. Instead of having to scratch the earth and to farm and be dependent on weather and rain and things, suddenly the buffalo, which was in, you know, vast numbers, was there for their taking, and everything they needed, they could get from it, you know, from weapons to religious objects to food to clothing to shelter, and because they were so rich, others coveted, you know, those riches, and so they had to defend it against anybody who tried to take it away from them, and they became very skilled at defending their homeland, and so. There was war, but there were also alliances formed, as, for example, between the Cheyenne and the Arapaho, who you know, were very close. Later, William Benn himself would oversee the alliance of the Cheyennes and the Arapahos with the Kiowas and the Comanches, who had been traditional enemies. So there was cooperation and alliances, and then there was warfare as well.
Yeah, and the warfare we've touched on a little bit with the loss of the arrows to the Kiowas in the 1830s. That was a devastating thing for the Cheyennes, but they were also occasionally at war with the Comanches, with the Utes, with the Blackfeet up in Montana. Occasionally they'd have fights with Lakota people, the Sioux. So there were enemies everywhere you looked. Perhaps the most traditional and fearful enemies were the Pawnees to the east. There was kind of a blood feud going on between the Pawnees and the Cheyennes by the time that that whites started heading west into Cheyenne territory.
Hmm. George was just 4 when his mother, Owl Woman, died. How was he and his brothers and sisters, I can't remember now how many children there were all together, 5, but how were the kids raised?
Well, the children were raised by the sisters of Owl Woman. Now, Owl Woman's mother actually died, his grandmother, in the cholera epidemic of 1849, and the family fled, as did all of the Cheyenne people. They just scattered in every direction, trying to outrun the disease that claimed nearly half of the southern Cheyennes. And the Bent children were raised by Owl Woman and her sisters, Island and Yellow Woman. And those kids grew up not really even knowing perhaps which was their birth mother. Those women took care of them as if they were their own. But George had a special bond, I think, with Island, the second sister. And when he would talk to his siblings, he would always say, "Our mother," and talk about Island, who was much later, during the Civil War, actually, killed by a group of soldiers and Pawnee scouts up in Powder River country, way to the north. In Montana and Wyoming, in the Northern Territory, and so they had this bond with all three of those sisters, but I think Island was special to them.
Hmm. You mentioned cholera. What impact did the disease cholera and other diseases have on those who survived?
Well, George talks about that. Specifically, he said that there were two great events in the more recent history of the Cheyennes that caused a breakdown of old traditions. And one was the cholera of 1849, and the other was the Sand Creek Massacre. So many were killed, and these half, as Andy said, half of southern Cheyennes died in the cholera, that the old taboos of the prohibitions against marrying within your clan or within family had to break down. There were so few survivors. So you find, for the first time, cousins marrying cousins, and that sort of thing. So the structure of Cheyenne life changed.
Hmm. How was it decided that the children would go to white schools?
Well, I think that was William Bent, the father's decision. You know, things around Bent's Fort got pretty wild after a time. Even for white explorers like John C. Fremont and his men who came through, they noticed that a bad set of people had gathered around the fort, drinking and carousing, prostitution among some of the Indian women became prevalent as they traded for commodities from the westering whites. And William said, "Hey, this is no place to raise children." William was always proud of his white upbringings, the civilization of the whites, and felt that the kids maybe were going a little bit too native, is how he put it. And so he packed them up and sent them off to what is now Kansas City and St. Louis, where they went to white schools, first a school for Indian or mixed blood kids, and then to colleges that were the best that St. Louis had to offer. So though George left his Cheyenne home when he was about 10 years old, he got the best education available in the West. And by the time the Civil War broke out in 1861, he had the equivalent of a college education.
Hmm. As I mentioned in my introduction, he signed up with the Confederate side when the war broke out. What led him in that direction?
Well, you know, his guardian in St. Louis and in Kansas City, both these guardians, different guardians, were pro-South and had slaves. And so he had a Southern, preference. But in fact, as well, other Indian kids that found themselves in St. Louis joined the Confederacy, as did the Cherokees and what were known as the five civilized tribes that are now identified with Oklahoma. They too were slaveholders, and so their allegiance was to the South. And George, like other Indian youths, chose that same path.
There was an incident that really incited George and some of his college chums. They happened to be in St. Louis at a time that Union troops, volunteer troops, were marching through the city, and they were beset by local folks from St. Louis, pro-Southern secessionist people, who started throwing rocks and shouting at the troops. And the troops, in a rage, turned on the mob and leveled their muskets and opened fire at point-blank range. Well, a score of people were felled in the fusillade, and George was right there. He witnessed the blood coursing through the cobbled streets of St. Louis, and he was outraged that federal troops would fire on citizens. And it was soon after that he and his friends just joined in a group, a Confederate cavalry unit, and went on to fight in the battles of Lexington and Wilson's Creek and the terrible slaughter at Pea Ridge, Arkansas. And then he was finally captured at the siege of Corinth, Mississippi in 1862.
Hmm. David Fridtjof Hollis and Andrew Masick are our guests this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. They are the authors of Half-Breed, The Remarkable True Story of George Bent, Caught Between the Worlds of the Indian and the White Man. George Bent was born in 1843 to a white trader and a Cheyenne woman. He was the product of two great families. He lived in both worlds, white and Indian. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, what was next for George Bent?
Well, after he was captured, we believe that he actually had deserted. He was taken to St. Louis, and the Bent name was so well known that he was recognized as he was marched through the streets. to the prison, and was eventually, in a couple days, released to his father's parole to his father at Bent's Fort. But when he arrived in St. Louis, there was a great surprise for him, and Andy has that story.
Well, when George got back to Sand Creek, he actually didn't get to Sand Creek right away. He got to Fort Lyon and found that the soldiers at Fort Lyon, which had once been one of Bent's, his father's trading posts, they didn't like the idea of a Southerner coming into their fort and lording it over them, and they threatened him. George's father, William, said, "You better go stay with your mother at Sand Creek," which is where the army officers had told Black Kettle's village to go camp, where they'd be safe. And George dutifully went to Sand Creek and was living there in a teepee, in a lodge, along with several hundred other people of Black Kettle's village, including his own brother, Charlie, was there. When one day, it was a cold day, November, late November 1864, that he heard, or actually felt, the thunder of horses' hooves through the ground. He leapt up out from under his buffalo robes and went outside of the teepee and saw U.S. troops riding down on the village. He saw Black Kettle and White Antelope, the principal chiefs of the village, holding up their hands, beseeching the soldiers not to come on any closer. But then he heard the report of rifles and then cannon and then the sound of the bullets ripping through the lodge skins in the village and then the screams of the women and children as they ran up the sandy creek, the dry creek bed where the Cheyennes had camped, and that's when all hell broke loose, and the killing and the slaughter began.
And this Sand Creek Massacre had a special meaning to the Bent family. When the troops were led by a man named John M. Shivington, Colonel Shivington, who hated Indians, wanted them annihilated. And as he marched towards the village, they came to William Bent's ranch, and he surrounded it and placed the Bent family, William, and under arrest. And then they took Robert Bent, George's brother, and by gunpoint forced him to join the soldiers and to lead the soldiers to the camp at Sand Creek. So leading this horde of soldiers was Robert Bent, and in the camp, George was there, his brother Charlie was there, his sister Julia was there, his stepmother was there, his family and relatives were all there. So It had a great significance for the Bents, and of course George never ever forgot it.
Yeah, what set that massacre in motion?
Well, I think the short story is that there had been tension between the people of the plains, the Indian people, and the westering whites. There had been occasional conflicts, but it wasn't a war. These were isolated incidents. But there was a colonel by the name of John Milton mm-hmm. Shivington, a Methodist Episcopal preacher prior to the Civil War. He had asked the government for a fighting commission during the Civil War. He was very ambitious, and he had actually won some battle honors fighting the Confederates, Texans who had invaded New Mexico and were en route to Colorado. He fought them to a standstill near Santa Fe, but that wasn't enough for him. He hoped to get a Brigadier General's star and then the top hat of a congressman, and he felt that he needed one more victory to get those things. And so he took a regiment of 100 days volunteers, they call them 100 daysers, and they were the 3rd Colorado Cavalry, volunteer cavalry, and he took them down to Sand Creek, where he knew that the officers at Fort Lyon had told the peaceful Cheyennes to camp. And he knew that the enlistments of his men were about to expire. They only had a couple of weeks left before they would be discharged from the service. So he knew he had to act fast. And so he surrounded that village and waded in. He once said, "I longed to be wading in gore." And when he was asked by a soldier, "Do we kill the little ones too?" he said, "I won't tell you what to do, but remember, nits make lice." Mm. And they killed everyone. Even the babies were shot down. And the women terribly mutilated. The men rode back to Denver with their saddle bows and their hats decorated with body parts as they rode, hoping to be back in Denver by Christmas.
Mm. What happened at Chivington, and what was the reaction of the territory there to this massacre?
Well, the territory, the white residents erupted in joy. They wanted the Indians annihilated, and Chivington was doing it for them. And they applauded him at a theater when the regiment displayed their trophies. They were delighted that this had occurred. But when the retaliation broke out, when the Cheyennes and their allies struck back, there was consternation, and there was some doubt now that this had been a good thing. Chivington got out of the army before any charges could be leveled against him. So he was not punished, but the United States in the Treaty of 1865 with the Cheyennes admitted guilt for Sand Creek and promised the victims reparations. Chivington himself had a very checkered career following Sand Creek. He went into a wagon business with a freighting business with his son, but when his son died, he, in order to get his son's half of the business, married his son's widow, and that caused people to talk. And of course, the Methodist Church, the Methodist Episcopal Church, kicked him out. Then he had trouble with. Then he had a divorce from her. Then he assaulted a woman in Washington D.C. in a hotel lobby, and she leveled charges against him. And he went on the lam to Canada for a couple of years. He married yet again, and she charged him with assault and battery. So this man, who stood 6 feet four, big chest, bellowing voice, was very much a bully. And in many ways, people understood that.
Hmm. But when he died, years later, in late 1880s, the largest funeral ever in the territory of Colorado up to that time occurred. The funeral procession went on for miles as they buried him, and people remembered him as the hero of Sand Creek and the protector of white civilization from the Indians. Remember, many of the whites in the territory at this time were avowed exterminationists. They believed that that was the only remedy for what they called the Indian problem.
And strangely, there is this cult following of Chivington that remains to this day. Some people feel that he has been maligned. And I think part of it is because they haven't seen the record that's available at the National Archives about some of the things Chivington did.
Boy, that's hard to believe.
But you can get a sense of the rage of the Cheyenne people in the aftermath of Sand Creek, and how George and many of the other young men of the Southern Cheyennes would join up with the Cheyenne dog soldiers, those men who were leading the resistance against the whites, as they went on a war path that took them from Colorado to Wyoming and Montana into Kansas, and they cut a swath of destruction that had never been seen before. They closed down the overland trails, they cut telegraph lines, they besieged cities and overran forts, and they were undefeated. These combined tribes and bands, once they linked up with the Lakotas in the north, they were unstoppable. Everything the army could throw at them was brushed aside.
Including the largest army ever to take the field against American Indians. And this is a story, that all of this occurred in 1865, that is largely untold.
Mm-hmm.
The tribes put down they fought the Americans, the American army, to a standstill. And those men under General Patrick Connor, who left Fort Laramie in July of 1865 to defeat the Cheyennes, returned in late September without their horses, without food, and without a single victory.
Hmm. How long did this fighting continue?
Well, that immediate, what Andy called the retaliation,
mm-hmm.
The tribes stayed together for almost a year, which is unheard of, considering, you know, the number of horses they had and the food that they had to get together. Amazing time. And it began January 7, 1865, when the Allied tribes struck at Julesburg, Colorado, in the northeastern part of the territory. And they struck on a 100-mile front, attacking every stage station, every ranch, every wagon train. The Army estimated that in those immediate days, over 250 whites were killed. Some 8,000 troops had to be diverted from eastern battlefields, and the cost of the war reached over $20 million. And you can think today of what that money, how much that would be.
Yeah. George Bent would eventually go to work for the government. And we're drawing down on time here, and this story is so big. I want to get to that part of the story, and then I want to get, of course, to the part of the story where he is determined to tell the story of the Cheyennes.
Let me take a stab. This is Andy.
Uh-huh.
About that middle period in which he came back from the war in 1865 and said, you know, there's no way we're going to win this. We had some temporary victories, but now that the Civil War is over, the United States government can bring overwhelming force to bear on the Allied tribes. And so he worked to form a peace between the two worlds. And he worked with Black Kettle, the chief whose village was massacred at Sand Creek. And even though people like Buffalo Bill Cody and Wild Bill Hickok came to him and said, won't you be a scout for the Army? We could use a guy like you. He said, no, I'm not going to go against my own people, but I will serve as an interpreter, mm-hmm. as an intermediary, as a negotiator between the two worlds. And that's what he did. And he was especially important at the 1867 Treaty of Medicine Lodge, in which he really got the tribes, including the Dog Soldiers, the most vocal opponents to peace with the whites. He even got them to sign the treaty, and for a time it seemed that there would be peace, and eventually the Cheyennes and many other tribes were relocated to Oklahoma. And it's there that after many years and after many pitfalls, George became the greatest spokesman for the Cheyennes and their greatest historian.
Hmm. Tell us about more about that. Did he begin to write, or was it, did he seek out others to help tell the story?
Well, he did both, but I think we have to, there was tremendous strain on George Bent. People were coming at him from all directions once they got into Oklahoma and onto the reservation. White cattlemen were trying to get sweet leases, on the reservation, and George was hobnobbing with the agent and helping to distribute food, and some of the chiefs began to look at him twice and say, "What's this guy doing?" So George later fell into alcoholism, and his drinking was the talk of the reservation at times. And that went on, and it caused the alienation of some of his children. He was having, everybody asking things of him, pulled and tugged, and it overwhelmed him. But in the late 1890s, he stopped his drinking, and he, because of his tremendous memory and intelligence and his experience, everybody looked to him to tell the history of the Cheyennes. And so when the great anthropologists and historians came calling, all the Indians pointed to George Bent and said, "If you want to know our history, you talk to him." It just so happened that George had the equivalent of a college education, could write. So he could do this through letters, or he could, when the anthropologists came to the reservation, he would set up interviews with all the elders, and they would listen to George. He was one of them at that time.
Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. You said that that war with the Allied tribes started with Julesburg, Colorado, and
following Sand Creek, yes.
Oh, okay, following Sand Creek. Now, I was just curious if you said that this is not very well, the story really isn't incorporated very well into American history.
Right.
If I wanted to follow up on this and to read a little bit more about it, aside from your book, would I find it under Julesburg, probably, or Sand Creek? Or
the Sand Creek Massacre is now very much in the news because of the creation of the Sand Creek National Historic Site. So if you look under Sand Creek, but if you look under Cheyennes as well, you'll come across books that were largely informed by George Bent. George Bird Grinnell's book called The Fighting Cheyenne is very important and has this in it. But by and large, the textbooks and high school history books don't mention either the Sand Creek Massacre or the 1865 wars.
Yeah, such a interesting history that you're bringing up. Just one other question, and it's a frivolous one, but I was curious: did Mr. Bent, when we think of half breed, we think of Hollywood type people that look kind of half Indian. Was that the case with him? Physically, too?
That's actually a very good question, and we should mention that they would call themselves mixed bloods or half bloods. Half breed was kind of a fighting term. You generally didn't say that to someone's face, and that's why we put it right there on the title, because they're kind of fighting words. But I'm looking at a picture of George Bent right now, taken in 1867 on probably the day that he was married to Magpie Woman. Black Kettle's daughter, and he's got jet black hair combed back. It's kind of just goes to mid-neck. He didn't keep it long and braided the way most Cheyenne men would. He has high cheekbones and kind of a bronzed complexion, and he's got a mustache, as many of the mixed bloods did. They sported mustaches. Sort of a symbol of their white side. Of course, Indian men would pluck the hair or shave the hair from their face. And he's very big. He's, 5'10", 5'11", broad shoulders, barrel chest, and he's wearing a suit of broadcloth, but on his feet there are quilled moccasins. And so that's kind of the George Bent look. He was a striking, handsome, and powerfully built man.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have to wrap it up here. I want to wrap it up by quoting from the Cheyenne Death song that you end the last chapter with, "Nothing lives forever, only the earth and the mountains." And then the last words of the epilogue are, "Nothing lives forever but memory."
I think that George Bent believed that he was doing a small part to preserve his people, to save his people by saving their memory. And that's what he did by telling the story.
And I want to thank the two of you for telling the story. Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Our guests this afternoon have been David Fridtjof Hollis and Andrew Masick. They are the authors of Halfbreed, the remarkable true story of George Bent, caught between the worlds of the Indian and the white man. The book is published by DeCapo Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. May wheat hit a high on the day of 282.5, a low of 274, settling at 374, settling at 380 up 7.5. July, a high of 391.5, a low of 383.5, settling 389.25 up 6.75. September, a high of 396.5, a low of 389.5, settling 393 up 4.5. December, a high of 406.5, a low of $4, settling 401.75 up 3.25. March, a high of 411, a low of 406, settling 407 up 2.5. It was a very mixed day on the in the corn pit and tilt just before the closing bell, when prices spiked above the onto the positive side. We'll be talking during the closing market report about that with Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services. May corn, a high of 314.5, a low of 307.75, settling 314 up 5.75. July, a high of 320.5, a low of 313.75, settling 319.75 up 5.5. September, a high of 316.25, a low of 309.5, settling 315.25 up 4. December, a high of 315.25, a low of 308.25, settling 313.5 up 3.5. March, a high of 318, a low of 312, settling 316.75 up 3.25. May, a high of 319.5, a low of 314.75, settling 318.75 up 3.75. July, a high of 320, a low of 314, settling 318.5 up 3.75. And December 05, a high of 276.5, a low of 273, settling 275, down a quarter on the day. May oats, a high of 172.25, a low of 168, settling 169.25, down 2.5. July, a high of 179.5, a low of 174, settling 176.5, down 2.5 on the day. Make no mistake about it, it is definitely a supply-driven, rationed-side soybean pit. On a fairly bullish U.S. Census report this morning, the prices gapped higher, and they just kept on climbing. May soybeans, a high on the day of 10.25, a low of 9.98, settling 10.14.5 up 18. July, a high of 10.10, a low of 9.82, settling at $10 even up 20. August, a high of 9.40, a low of 9.21, settling 9.30.5 up 12.5. September, a high of 8.11, a low of 7.90, settling 8.04.5 up 11.5. November, a high of 7.41, a low of 7.24.5, settling 7.37 up 4.5. January, a high of 7.42.5, low of 7.27, settling 7.37 up 6.5. March, a high of 7.31, a low of 7.20, settling 7.29 up 3. May soybean meal, a high of 311.70, a low of 305, settling 310.70 up 420. July soybean meal, a high of 311, a low of 303.50, settling 308.70 up 32. And then what began the rally was the soybean oil pit, where tight supplies made for a number of people entering the market, including the funds today. May soybean oil, a high of 35, a low of 33.75, settling 34.57 up 99. July, a high of 34.33, a low of 33.45, settling 34.02 up 93. The settlement prices are also in over on the Merck. And Celeste, you have those?
I do, and livestock prices higher today, Dave. April feeder cattle, 96.25. The high, 96 even. The low, 96.22.5. The settlement, that up 45. May, 98.60. The high, 96.90. The low, 97.47.5. The settlement, that up 40. August, 99.60, the high, 97.25, the low, 98.40, the settlement, that up 27.5. April live cattle, 87.75, the high, 86.60, the low, 87.65, the settlement, that up 82.5. June, 82.15, the high, 80.05, the low, 81.05, the settlement today, that up 60. August live cattle, 82.90, the high, 81.20, the low, 82.22.5, the settlement, that up 5. October live cattle, 83.55, the high, 82.10, the low, 82.95, the settlement, that down 10. May lean hog, 73.55, the high, 72.55, the low, 73.42.5, the settlement, that up 35. June, 73.20, the high, 71.60, the low, 72.07.5, the settlement, that down 57.5. July, 73.95, the high, 72.50, the low, 73.35, the settlement, that down 27.5. August lean hog, 71.60, the high, 70.65, the low, 71.15, the final price, that down 10. May bellies, 111.90, the high, 108.90, the low, 111 even, the settlement, that up 135. The Dow down 61 points at 10,282. The NASDAQ is off 33 points at 1956. The S&P 500 is 9 lower at 1114.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Illini Studio, Champaign; Illinois Graphics Incorporated, Bloomington; Lincoln Diagnostics Incorporated, Decatur; and the High School of St. Thomas More, Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Marjorie Peters from Tempe, Arizona writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why don't animals need glasses?"
Most animals do need glasses, but try convincing them. Veterinary optometry's moment in the sun was short-lived. For a brief period in the early 50s, many pets were fitted with eyeglasses. Most of these pets committed suicide rather than face the scorn of their myopic peers. New extended wear contact lenses were developed for pets, but test marketing proved the idea unprofitable. Pet owners refused to buy the lenses because other pet owners would be unsure of their existence. So we see dogs bumping into fire hydrants and cats batting at little invisible squiggly things in a beam of sunlight. The tragedy is it's all so preventable.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.